Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. In 1968, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. started the Poor People's Campaign with the goal of fighting racism, poverty, and militarism. King's campaign came during the height of the Civil Rights Movement and the Vietnam War. 50 years later, the protest movement has been reignited in three dozen states, including here in Pennsylvania. The Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, is a six-week series of nonviolent protests that not only targets racism, poverty, and militarism, but adds ecological devastation and mass incarceration to the issues that they're protesting. Joining us today is Leslie Avila, who is with the Movement of Immigrant Leaders, and Rabbi Michael Pollack with March on Harrisburg. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, here's the broad question, and we're going to get into some specifics later, but what are you trying to achieve?
We are trying to shift the moral narrative of our times. We are trying to shift the moral narrative from one where being poor is a sin to one where poverty is a sin. Trying to shift it from one where being homeless is a sin to homelessness being a sin. So trying to shift it away from this hyper-individualized focus on how poor people are inherently immoral or wrong or should be ashamed or all of that stuff that floats around, and shift it to a narrative where we are responsible for each other. And that's kind of the broad goal of all of this.
Who says that poor people are immoral or these morals need to be changed?
Oh, I hear it every day. Hear it on the radio, hear it on the news, hear it from politicians who blame poor people for being poor. You know, in the last election cycle, we really didn't hear anything about poverty. We didn't hear anything about poor people. Now all politicians even talk about is just the middle class and jobs for the middle class. And we've really forgotten about poor people in this country. And the fact is that we have so many poor people today in the United States of America and in Pennsylvania. 1 in 8 children in Pennsylvania lives in deep poverty. 1 in 2 children in Pennsylvania lives in an income insecure household. We're living through an epidemic of poverty, and we need to take it on and focus on it.
Why is it you think that we don't hear about poor people? We don't hear about poverty?
I guess, well, mainly the reason I would say is because, no one has given them the power and the platform to speak up about being poor and to be confident about it enough to say. And that's what I feel like we're trying to do with the moral narrative, is give people the understanding, like, you're not poor because you made bad decisions. You're poor because the system was set up in a way where it makes it hard to be raised in a household that is poor and get out of that. It's possible. You've seen and you've heard the stories, but the system is set up in a way that it's very hard to do. And some people get very down on themselves and depressed and anxious filled when they kind of see their whole life story. And they're like, well, I made these bad decisions and I've got myself here. And it's like, it's not all you,
But let me just push back against that for a moment, because there would be, and we know that it is difficult for someone who has grown up in poverty to escape that.
Correct.
When that is what their life has been. And a lot of times they don't know how to get out of poverty. Mm-hmm. But aren't there people who have made bad decisions who those decisions have kept them there? Maybe it's for lack of knowledge, mm-hmm. but have made bad decisions.
Correct. There's a lot of people who have made bad decisions. And actually, if you knew the bad decisions that I've made, you wouldn't ask me to come in this room right now. You wouldn't have asked me to come to this room. And I think that's the whole basis of our movement, is really that people aren't the decisions they've made. People are the decision they are making right now to make a different life for themselves. And that's, someone asked me just 2 days ago, well, people can do bad things and can recover, And I said, well, are you who you were yesterday, or are you what you thought yesterday? Your thoughts in your head, you might have had bad thoughts yesterday, but today are you waking up with a completely new attitude? Are you helping your uncle recover from alcohol addiction, etc.? I feel like nobody should be judged on a past action, because even people ask, you know, I work with kids today, and if they knew what I did when I was a kid, they'd be like, well, why are you working with us? It's because I learned from my mistake and I grew out of it.
But that's, you know, and I don't want to get into a big philosophical conversation, but, you know, what you're saying is so true, that we all have made bad decisions. But what's the difference? Why can some people overcome those bad decisions and, you know, escape from poverty? I hate to use the word escape, but, you know, make it to the middle class or above. What's the difference?
Every human being has potential to accomplish a whole lot. And when you are in poverty, the odds are stacked against you. So the amount of effort it takes to accomplish something is just much greater than it is for somebody who's born into privilege and who grows up in a upper class or upper middle class lifestyle. So people have the ability to redeem themselves, and it's hard, and people are able to do it through really, I don't want to say superhuman effort, but it's really what it takes when you're in deep poverty to get out of it. It takes a community. It takes a whole lot of love and support. It takes a whole lot of sacrifice of the village, of the family, of the community to get people out of that deep poverty.
What's unique about the Poor People's Campaign? I mean, a lot of people, when I mentioned to a lot of people that we're going to be talking about this today, said, oh, is that like Occupy Wall Street? What's different?
The Poor People's Campaign is really an amazing movement. It's really an amazing time in history right now because it is a nonviolent moral fusion direct action movement. So the moral fusion section. So the Poor People's Campaign has brought groups together that usually don't work together. It's brought all these activists and organizers out of their silos, out of their issue silos. So you see right now we have an immigration person and a democracy person sitting together as part of this campaign. We have mass incarceration groups. We have indigenous groups. We have healthcare groups. We have environmental groups. That we have labor groups, and so we've all kind of come out of our silos and joined together to really form this new and unsettling force.
To add to that, yesterday, for example, we had a lady named Brenda come from, I don't know what part of, I remember, forget what part of the state she is
Philly.
From, but Philly, night, no, it wasn't Brenda, that Brenda. It was another Brenda, sorry.
So more than one Brenda with a campaign.
Yeah, came in from, you know, just places, not from the city, you know, just way out north. And she told a story that about, kind of referring to your last question as well, told a story about how her boyfriend is in jail for a crime that her boyfriend's friend committed. Her boyfriend's friend had more money than her boyfriend. He was able to get out about 26 years ago from prison for the crime he committed. Her boyfriend is currently still in jail 30 years later because he couldn't afford a good lawyer. So that's also the struggle of poor people. And the fact that she came out from like 4 hours into the forest and came out to the Capitol really showed something that someone like that and someone like me that's just lived in the city their whole life can meet and can talk about things that have affected the both of us, and we never got the chance to even talk about our similarities because maybe, you know, we were split up because of our differences before, but now it's, that doesn't matter. Our, you know, whether you're on Twitter or whether you're on Facebook, hashtag across all differences, across all borders. Because when there's a dog biting her and a dog biting me, we're coming out and we're saying, hey, like, I don't like that dog, you know, but wait, you're a different color than me. I don't care. Your dog's attacking you just as much as it's attacking me. And I feel like that's the big, unique part of the Poor People's Campaign, just like Michael was saying, is just getting people that never even talked.
You said nonpartisan. Are there Republicans?
There are people, yes, is the basic assumption. There are definitely Democrats, there are definitely some Republicans, and then there's a lot of people who are out of the system, people who would identify as independents, people who are fed up with both parties. And we definitely have people who don't vote, who are that checked out of the system that has failed them so much over so many years that they just check out. And that's where we are right now in Pennsylvania and in the U.S., where...
No, go ahead.
We're all just really fed up with the status quo. And so we look at the Poor People's Campaign looks at both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and says, you're not doing enough. You're failing.
And I'd like to make a stance that we don't really ask.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what Michael votes, and I don't know what, you know, people that I've met yesterday vote, because I don't really care. You know, I know what you're struggling through and I know what I'm struggling through, and let's get to the point. talking about all the specifics, like, okay, cool, you know, you're Republican. Yeah.
No, but when you say nonpartisan and you hear where you stand on some issues, let's face it, unfortunately, in this country that identifies with one party or the other, but there are more and more people identifying as independents or non-affiliated voters. Something you just said, and I wanted to follow up on it. I mentioned that this is a six-week campaign initially, 40 days, actually. I understand that there are plans after that, and part of that is voter registration. And let me just add to that as part of this question that, you know, we've been told over the hundreds of years that the best way to affect change is to vote. But you were just saying, Rabbi, that... you know, you have a lot of people who are so checked out, they don't vote. So how are you going to get them to vote, and what are you going to get them to vote for?
So it's not just voting. If you vote and then leave the politicians alone, nothing changes because they know that you're not watching. So it's getting people to vote and then following up at the Capitol later, meeting with these people, meeting with the politicians, and really trying to move them over time, you know, during non-election years too, especially. And so, yeah, we are going to be doing a voter registration drive of some kind. And we're really not going to be focusing it like they usually are in the cities. We're not really just going to focus on Philly and Pittsburgh and Harrisburg. We're going to go out into the rural areas because this is such a nonpartisan effort, and it's such a movement that's breaking down all these divides. And so we are giving people, we're trying to present an opportunity for people to vote and to be part of the political system. But we're also saying to them, that's not it. Because so many times we're told just vote, go home, and the politicians will take care of it. And so we're telling people, yes, come and vote, and stay with us. Stay with us. We're doing stuff into the future. Keep coming back to the Capitol. One of the most amazing things, there's so many amazing things about this movement, but one thing that really gets me is that this is happening in state capitals. Right? So many movements say, go to D.C., go to Congress. That's where it all comes from. But it really doesn't. So much of our policy is determined on the state level and at more local levels. As far as education funding goes, you know, 7% comes from the federal government, 93% comes from local governments. So we really have to be focusing on the state. And our state legislature, I can only speak about Harrisburg because I live here. So our state legislature here, they don't think anybody's paying attention. They really don't think anybody cares. Most of them run unopposed. They feel like they're totally safe to do whatever they want to do. And so we're telling people, vote good people into office, whatever party that may be, and then follow up with them. We're going to stay engaged. This is a movement for the long term. This is not 40 days. This is 40 days as a beginning, as a commencing. And this is going to go decades into the future.
How do you educate or inform voters, though? Because unfortunately, because so many people have checked out, and that's one reason, when people go to vote, often they make their decisions based on television commercials mm-hmm. that they've seen that are, you know, I don't know, 75% misleading. So how do you not only get people to vote to affect their future, but keep them informed on the issues, educate them on issues?
Education is a huge part of this campaign. We have a political education team that does internal education every single week. It's absolutely beautiful, and we try to share that externally as much as possible. And people can tune into a live stream tonight at 7:30 through the Poor People's Campaign Facebook page and really sit in on a political education session. Mm-hmm. And we're really asking people who were going to be registering to vote to ask their politicians questions that they never hear so that they actually learn and put them on the spot about poverty, put them on the spot about ecological devastation and the war economy and systemic racism, because the moderators at debates don't ask these questions, mm-hmm. and the TV commercials mm-hmm. never get to them.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. Two people part of that campaign today with us, Rabbi Michael Pollack of March on Harrisburg and Leslie Avila, who is with Movement of Immigrant Leaders. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk. WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call from David in Lemoyne. David, you're on the air.
Hello. There's a conundrum here that I'm trying to get a handle on. I think most people would agree that the Trump administration it does not pander to the people that you're talking about. As a matter of fact, they pretty much represent the other side of the coin, the very wealthy. And how do you explain then that a large percentage of the sort of lower income, disenfranchised, lower educated people in this country are among what they call Trump's base? And if I may make a suggestion as to why that might be, another side of the low income population are minorities, and I think the ones that voted for Trump are mostly white. And I think the reasoning for them is lack of education and racism.
Hey, thank
and
David.
That's sort of what I wanted to hear you discuss.
David, thank you very much for your call.
So we, as the Poor People's Campaign, we try really not to talk down to voters and to people, but really to talk with people. And the Trump phenomenon, in large part, was really a brick through the beltway glass. It was a frustration with decade after decade of economic decline, of changes that just don't benefit the majority of America. And it was really this moment of let's just break the whole system. Let's just burn it all down. And, you want to speak to the racial component of it?
So you mentioned a part where you talked about how poor people are the base of Trump's campaign and Trump supporters. You know, a lot of them were poor and, you know, they let's go for a great America that brings a lot of, you know, economic richness to our country. But the fact is, we're not thinking about the people who are poor and never got the opportunities to even, let's say, get that education, like you said, uneducated people. And so right now, I guess the Poor People's Campaign, it's hard to say because we don't want to really focus on what Trump brought and Trump supporters, because like we said, we're nonpartisan. But that brought up a big conversation about how Trump wanted to bring economic greatness, you know, but speaking on my behalf, what about the immigrants that are here poor that pay taxes, federal and local, just like every other citizen, but can't get the jobs that, you know, he claimed to bring to the United States of America. So that's just a little component for you. And my opinion is some of these people who are paying taxes like everybody else can't get those jobs. And so we're forgetting a large margin of those poor people.
But you brought up immigration.
Let's do it.
And that was one of the reasons. That was ready. One of the reasons that, you know, from the very beginning that Donald Trump, when he announced his candidacy, talked about immigrants in a very negative way. And I think getting back to the caller's question is that many of the, you know, when people have asked why, tried to analyze why Trump won the election, is that there were people say that, you know, there was a segment of America that liked hearing that they did not want more illegal immigrants in this country, that they did not want more immigrants, period, in this country, and that there could be some racism involved. How do you respond to that?
So there's definitely a lot of people that got excited when Trump stood up and said all these hateful things. It's like, oh, someone think, you know, God bless those people, but someone thinks like me. Oh, yes, let's vote for him. Let's put him in power. And that's very scary, but also very, for me, it was a curtain unfolding, because now we saw what was behind the curtain in America all these years. You know, people kept quiet about this stuff. People felt like this at home. And when Trump won candidacy and people started to come out and start to say these hateful things, you know, with more confidence, it kind of was like, oh, so you felt like this the whole time. For me, it was this is a weird way to put it, but it was like a brick was taken off my shoulder. You know, it was like I took a sigh, because now we know what we're up against. You understand? And only when you see that monster can you really tackle it. So now I know what I'm up against. And it's very sad, honestly, because people don't understand the struggle that immigrants came through or why they even came here. You understand? There was a quote yesterday that a man named Esvin, he said when he was speaking at the Capitol, and it's, we're not poor because we're immigrants. We're immigrants because we are poor. You think I wanted to leave my family and my culture of years to come into this country? No. Ecological devastation and poverty brought me to this country. And now I am following these country's rules. And there is available jobs that I got fairly, you know. And everybody's, you know, talking down on me. I'm a human being and my country wasn't doing me right. And your country has a lot of money to do right by everybody. And so why is that country shutting its doors on people who, you know, who their country didn't do it right? And then we see the segregation of people's countries. No, well, this is my country. This is my country. That's just another specific to separate all of us.
One final follow-up on our caller's question. One of the things he was getting at is that the base, it's often referred to as the base of the mm-hmm. people who were hardcore Trump supporters, that now that Donald Trump has been in office, that many of the policies that have been adopted and have been enacted would seem to go against the base, that would be policies that wouldn't necessarily help those white working poor, if that's who the base is. So the question, and this is kind of a political or philosophical question, why do people continue to support someone who is going against their best interest?
So let's be really clear about who Donald Trump is first. He's a corporate raider. I mean, this is a guy who looks at the world with dollar signs on everything and tries to extract as much wealth as possible for himself and his friends and those who are close to him. So of course he was never going to end poverty. Of course he was never going to bring back these jobs and help people. That was never going to happen. But people are willing to go along with that because that's a dream. I mean, that's everybody wants a good job. Everybody has a right to live. Everybody wants to be prosperous. And people go along with it because he's really good at playing to the most base fear instincts in human beings. Because we all have that in us. We all have the capability to be afraid. And we all have the capacity to close the doors of ourselves and our country and whatever because we're so afraid. And he's really good at scaring people. He's really good with the hate speech.
So what instincts, and I hate to put it as you just did, as playing to, but what instincts do you want to conjure up in people?
Love. It's that simple. We don't want to divide, and frankly, we don't even want to talk about the current president.
But you just said, realistically, yeah. Okay, love, but realistically, basically pointed out that there are a lot of people who don't like other people because of the way they look, where they come from, what they believe, and in this culture today, this country today, bigger division maybe than we've had since the Civil War. Mm-hmm. So realistically, what do you want to... Okay,
absolutely.
It would be nice if everyone loved each other.
Yeah, and so what does that look like? So the Poor People's Campaign is really working to heal these divisions in our society and to bring people together across rural and urban divides, across red and blue divides, across conservative, liberal, progressive, whatever divides. And we do that really by creating space for people to come together. So it's been really beautiful to come out to Harrisburg on these Mondays for these actions in the state capitol, and there are people who have never interacted with each other. And a basic fact of humanity is that when we expose ourselves to the other that we fear in a safe way, we tend to emerge from the situation with some love.
Mm-hmm. And for me, two words, understanding and awareness, right? So what are we understanding? So just like Michael said, when people are in fear, they tend to not hear other stories, right? I'm scared of your kind, whatever that is. But when we come to a safe space and we hear the other person talk and we hear their story, right? A lot of times we just listen, but we have passive listen, right? So when you really sit down and listen to somebody, you can understand their story and where they came from. And even though it might, you know, maybe you have years of family racism that's been, you know, put down by your family. But when you really hear and listen to someone, you start to understand something and you click something like, this person has been through a lot and I've been through a lot. The specifics are different, right? We've been through different things. But as a person, you've been through a lot and you're going through a lot of emotional turmoil. And if I am helping that, if I'm helping the monster get that emotional turmoil out of you, I am part of the reason why you are so anxious and depressed and why you've been put down for so long. So do we want to do that to someone else, even though we know how that feels, right? So then that understanding comes, and it comes out of love. If I love myself and I don't want anybody to treat me like this, I would never treat someone else the way I don't want to be treated. As simple as that sounds, we should have learned this in kindergarten, but it's hard.
It's a golden rule.
Exactly.
And it's another shift that we're really working on is moving people away from that selfish starting point toward a selfless starting point. So instead of asking the question, what's going to happen to me if I help somebody else, ask the question, what's going to happen to the other person if I don't help, if I don't stand up?
Let's take a phone call from Nancy in Mechanicsburg. Nancy, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I greatly admire and honor the work that you're doing. I've been engaged in very similar work for many years in the disability community, people with intellectual and developmental disabilities as well as physical disabilities. And when you listed the groups of oppressed representatives, I think it was Rabbi Pollack at the beginning, I didn't hear you mention that piece of our population, which is about 2% of the population being people with intellectual disabilities and autism. And the issue that we face regarding poverty is very much rooted in stigma. And you talked about a lot about the systems and bringing different oppressed groups together to share and find common ground, but what is your strategy, really, to dig deeper? Because to me, it's the generic community at large. It's our society and our culture at large that really holds on to the stigma that creates the barriers to love and the barriers to opportunity. So I'd be really curious to see, A, if you've engaged with the disability community, and B, your strategy for reaching, not just finding common ground among oppressed people, but for really opening up the minds and hearts of the stigmatizers.
Thank you very much for your call. And disabled was one of the things that you had, was it last week?
Last week.
Yeah. Okay. Talk about that.
Absolutely. So each of these 6 weeks has a theme. So yesterday was mass incarceration, immigration, voter suppression, indigenous community rights, Islamophobia, and xenophobia. Last week was the disabled community. So we did have speakers come in who really, you know, one of the goals of this whole campaign, as Reverend William Barber says, is to make America cry, to make America feel something. And last week we had speakers who came in from the disabled community who really made America cry, made Pennsylvania cry. There was one woman who came in with a story about how the state took away her child as soon as the child was born because the state determined that she was unfit to raise a kid. And she's standing there saying, I finally found my son after 20-some years. I'm totally capable of I could have raised him, but the state decided no. We had people come up and say, I depend on, you know, Medicaid to get by. I depend on that. And if I don't have Medicaid, I'm going to be institutionalized. And right now, that's always under attack. And, you know, one of the beautiful things about these rallies that we're holding and these educational forums that we have is that we don't let the standard nonprofit executives speak. We don't turn over the microphone to people who are used to being in front of the microphone. So we have people telling their stories, their first-person narratives, so that we can break down those walls and so that we can see each other honestly and hear each other and feel for each other.
You know, a few things that Nancy said that I'd like to follow up on, and she talked about stigma, and that does go back to what you were talking about originally, mm-hmm. about poor people being stigmatized. Oh, you're poor. You're a poor person, and in my mind, I'm saying, you're representing what some people would think, is that's what you are, and again, you must have done something wrong, made a mistake along the way, so there is that stigma that does exist, which does go to create resentment in a lot of people as well. The other thing she brought up, you have a lot of... You have some big goals, some lofty goals.
World peace.
Is there potential for when you're trying to change so much, when you are looking at so much, that you're not effective because you are looking at so much rather than focusing on one or two?
So to go back on your first mention just about stigma, we can only do so much to change people's minds, and that's sad. But I feel like the listening and understanding part is a big part of it. I met this wonderful woman named Wanda, and she really opened my eyes to how mental disability can really hold you back from maintaining a stable job. One day you might wake up on the worst side of the bed, excuse me, and you can't go into work. People who have never had a mental disability or have never come across it don't understand this. You know, we'll just get out of bed and go to work. It's not that simple. And sometimes our healthcare doesn't cover the cost of some people or of us going to, you know, a mental therapist or to go into places that would be able to help us with our mental wellness. And so then how am I going to pay to get better? You know, if I obviously my job, you know, has put me on a 2-week detention because I couldn't come into work today because I woke up so bad. How am I supposed to then pay for the mental wellness that's supposed to get me better if my health care is then being taken away? So it's this kind of cycle. And when people
can I interrupt for just 1 second?
Go ahead.
Because one thing, let's talk about a specific. One of the things that you're advocating is universal health care.
Yes. A human right, as crazy as it might sound.
how do you pay for it? That's mm-hmm. That's one question. And the second question is, politically, how do you overcome the objections that some people see it as, move towards socialism?
First off, how do you pay for it is easy. This is the richest country in the history of the world. Countries that do not have the wealth of the United States of America are able to guarantee health care as a human right. There is no reason at all that we should not be able to do that as well. And how do you overcome the political stigma? I think that our political conversation is totally disconnected from the reality on the ground. I think that our politicians have that conversation about, is this socialism? Is this, you know, is there a free market option or whatever? But if you go to there were some PPC volunteers at a free dental clinic in Reading the other day, and they were asking everybody, do you think healthcare is a human right? And they all said, absolutely, it's a human right. And these were people who were, you know, Republican, Democratic voters, independents, libertarians, across the spectrum, because everybody gets sick. You know, everybody needs health care at some point in their life. It's a human right.
And a lot of the politicians that are writing some of the laws, you know, that affect health care have never been diagnosed with anxiety because of financial instability. They don't know what that feels like to be worried if your child is going to eat. So, you know, I have met people and that don't really catch the strength and the length of mental wellness. So they don't understand that, yeah, anxiety is a big thing, and anxiety can affect you on a day-to-day basis.
Let me get back to that question, though, that Nancy had, that before we take some more phone calls here. When she was talking about that focus and focusing on so many different issues, or, you know, spreading yourself thin is, you know, I think the question that she was asking.
I think that it's a wise strategy to be as ambitious as we are, because there really isn't that voice in American society right now that's staking a flagpole for justice and for what is right. And we look back to the prophet, you know, this is a prophetic movement. It's led by two reverends, Reverend William Barber and Reverend Liz Theo Harris. And if you read the prophets, they are staking out large, large claims. I mean, we're going to end war. You know, we're going to melt down every weapon and only have peace. We're going to end poverty. We're going to be a moral society. So it's important to stake out those ambitions so that we can start to move toward them.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking with Leslie Avila of the Movement of Immigrant Leaders and Rabbi Michael Pollack of March on Harrisburg. They're part of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. You've probably heard about the first 6 weeks, first 2 weeks of the campaign that started. I shouldn't say it started in Washington. Washington was part of it, but it's in 36 states around the country. If you have a question or a comment, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call from David in Duncannon. David, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm an old white guy. I haven't missed a vote in 46 years. And I'm telling you, the power is in the vote. You can talk all you want, But until you can get poor people to vote in large numbers, the politicians, you don't even exist, you know? And I'm just afraid that until they can mobilize a vote and get rid of Trump, nothing's going to happen because Trump is not friends of the poor.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. Let's address his, the first part of what he said. And the people who run for office, they do talk to the people who vote. And we know in this country often that is an older person, very often a Caucasian person. So how do you get now? There are more younger people getting involved. But the point he makes about mobilizing poor people to vote in their own interest, how do you do that?
It's crucial to mobilize people to vote, absolutely. And it's absolutely so, so important to vote and to vote out bad politicians and to vote in good leaders, for sure. But we also have to acknowledge the distortions in our vote and how our vote gets distorted along the way. So through things like voter suppression, through things like gerrymandering, through things like unlimited campaign financing, our vote really becomes meaningless. And so we have to really change the system as we vote in better politicians. So for example of how a vote gets distorted, you know, I live in the old 7th District of Pennsylvania, you know, goofy kicking Donald Duck or whatever. And I went in to lobby a congressman, Shaka Fitah. I think it was a different district, one district over. And I went in to lobby him in 2014 before he was indicted on 50 counts of corruption, and he's currently serving a 10-year sentence or something like that. And I went in and I said, Congressman, you are the head of the Progressive Anti-War Caucus in the House of Representatives. You are supposed to be the most anti-war representative ever. And he said, yes. And I said, well, you've taken last year, you took 13,000 from Raytheon, 15,000 from Lockheed Martin, 17,000 from Boeing, the big three arms manufacturers in the country. And you voted for every single military spending increase that crossed your desk. So who do you really represent? And his response was, out of everybody in the last election, I got the most votes nationwide for Congress. I said, well, that's because your district is 95% Democrat. It's been totally gerrymandered. So we think we're voting for an anti-war progressive, but we're not. We're just not. And because our vote really gets distorted, because when we send these leaders with these politicians into, whether it's the U.S. House of Representatives or whether it's Harrisburg, wherever it is, they get consumed by the system and they get consumed by the swamp through just a series of incentives that incentivize bad behavior. And so we do have to vote good people in, and simultaneously we have to keep the pressure on. We have to keep the pressure on, especially in non-election years. We got to be at their door. We have to be in the state capitol. We have to be raising up our voices, and we have to be heard.
So another part of that is, so a lot of immigrant groups go to the court where people get their citizenship, and as soon as they get their citizenship, they go and they say, hey, let's get you registered to vote. So we understand the importance of that when we're trying to get every new citizen in this country to get registered to vote and to understand the importance of voting, not just federal, but local voting as well. But I also just want to put in a part, a lot of people here are not allowed to vote. A lot of the people that I work with or the people that I love, you know, they can't vote. So it's like, so you know, what do I just do? Either they're undocumented or they're a resident, not a citizen yet. There's a lot of folks like that. Again, they pay taxes just like everybody else. But besides that, you know, it's like, well, what do? I can't vote. And there's still a part for people that can't vote as well. And we can't forget that either. So just like Michael said, that pressure, you know, being at the Capitol every day, they're going to get tired, you know, and even if they can, you know, avoid us all they want, pressure really kills them. Calling into your local congressman or your local representative and just leaving them about 30 messages every day saying, I do not support this legislation. I do not support this legislation. And you can tell them, you know, you tell them your address and where you live and your constituent. And the secretary, you know, tallies up how many people called and what are the hot topics that they called about. And then based off of that, you know, they go and represent that to the representative that we're calling and tell them, you know, well, your constituents are saying this. So I think really pressure works a lot.
Absolutely. And this is a nonviolent movement through and through. And Gandhi had a word, the word Gandhi used to use for nonviolence was satyagraha. And satya is this absolute truth. And graha is really the key word for me here. Graha is this intense obsession. This it's almost like being a bulldog that's kind of bit the back of a bumper of a speeding car and never, never, ever lets go. And that's how we have to engage in our democracy. We have to engage with an obsession, with a zealotry almost, with a passion. We have to not let go. We turn a blind eye to our politicians, and then they're just in the back rooms with the donors and lobbyists, and they don't do what's for the benefit of everyone. They do what's for the benefit of their donors.
Let's take a few calls here. Carol is in Camp Hill. Carol, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Hey, well, I'm kind of going back to a little bit earlier in your program when I came in and I heard them say, can you still hear me okay?
We're kind of losing you, but go ahead.
There you go. Okay. Well, anyway, my observation is, you know, going back to when you were saying something along the lines of that it was poor right here and people who had voted for Trump, my observation was, sure, some of the people that I'm aware of were, you know, jerky and racist and ignorant. However, most of the people that I know are from many tax brackets. And the common denominator I found was that even when GOP politicians were denouncing him, it just kept fueling people more. And what I had, my observation was that Trump had morphed into like a Molotov cocktail that those people wanted thrown on top of all of Washington. They were mad at all of them for what they felt was like the country was being run into the ditch by all of them.
Hey, Carol, thank you very much for your call. And that kind of goes along the lines you're saying. But one thing I'd like to add here, I don't know whether I heard this correctly or not, but referring to all Trump voters as jerky and ignorant, and that doesn't get anything accomplished. I mean, there have been a lot of friends who voted for Donald Trump and know of a lot of good people who voted for Donald Trump. Doesn't mean that they all are, that they're bad people, put it that way. So, okay, I just put that out there as a disclaimer.
Absolutely. Yeah. And yes, I think that the caller is right that this Trump was essentially a Molotov cocktail into the Beltway window because people are so disconnected. People are so alienated. People are so frustrated with decade after decade of just things getting worse, things getting more unequal, social services breaking down, the institutions we depend on breaking down, our society getting more cruel and less compassionate. And yeah, but I also really want to stress that this campaign is not about the current president of the United States of America. This campaign was being planned before the 2016 election. It would be happening no matter who won in November of 2016. And also, I just want to stress that Donald Trump is not, he's not the most racist president we've ever had. I mean, Woodrow Wilson showed the birth of a nation in the Oval Office. We have presidents who are slave owners. We have presidents who committed genocide. I mean, he's not even close. So he's nothing new in American society. We've seen this before. And the way to overcome this is through a mass fusion movement, people coming together, people reaching across all lines, and people believing in the possibility of redemption.
Let's go to John in Harrisburg. John, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks. Hi. Yeah, first, I'm offended by being called a racist. That's ridiculous. Trump never said anything. He even went to the Martin Luther King dedication. A racist, you know, doesn't do that. And as far as poor people, my grandfathers were both poor when they came to America, nothing but the shirt on their backs. They worked 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, saved up for years and years, bought their own businesses eventually. So there's a way out of poverty, but it is jobs. You have to get jobs. And you're right about other presidents screwing up. We had Bush, Carter, Obama, they all went along with letting our businesses go overseas. We lost so much industry. Poor people need jobs. Trump knows that. He's got the lowest unemployment rate of African Americans in history. So he's working on it. You get those jobs, you'll get people out of poverty. Thank you for your time. Right. I appreciate it.
John, thank you very much for your call. Jobs.
So I want to say first, John, thank you so much. And I don't think we specifically called anybody that voted for Trump racist, or maybe, you know.
No, I think he was referring to.
Okay. Okay.
I called Trump racist.
Oh, okay. Okay. Awesome. So, but John, I want to say that I love you just as much as I love any other person in the world. Whether you voted for him or not, or you thought he was saying something great, I honestly do. I love you as a person. You're probably a good person. Just like you said, your grandparents came here poor. You know, you understand that people, you know, need to live, pretty much. And that's the basic thing, is everybody has a right to live, right, in America. And then on the second part, I'd like to point out something specific, right? So we all need jobs. A person who just came out of a federal prison with a felony, you know, let's say he's been there for a bit and he wants to change his life, right? And he's really actually changed, you know, mentally, spiritually, physically, soulfully, you know, just wants to make a change, right? Now, how hard do you think it is for someone like that to get a job with a felony on their record? And that's just one specific. There's many examples I could give you. And I'm not taking away the importance of jobs. I think it's very important. But right now we're shifting the narrative to, okay, so we need jobs, but why can't people get jobs? Why can't people maintain a job? And not through blaming them, but really looking at everyone's specific story, breaking that down and seeing how everybody around them can help them. And the system can also lend a hand to one of their constituents and one of the people just on this earth with them, right? So not everybody can get a job that easily. And it's not just about the jobs. We're going really behind the scene of the job and asking you, if you can't get a job and you can't keep it, then why? And me as a person that's pretty, you know, I have nothing else to do in life. Let's say I'm in summer of college, which I am. I let me lend a hand to someone like you and let me try to help you. And we believe at the Poor People's Campaign that it's everyone's responsibility to make sure everybody is good.
We only have about 4 minutes, and I'm going to try to cover a lot here in 4 minutes. Now, a couple of other issues. Coalition to Abolish Death by Incarceration is one of the groups that involved in campaign. Mass incarceration, what do you want to see there?
We want to see an end to mass incarceration. It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, I mean,
we lock up a whole lot of people disproportionately, people of color, and that has got to end. I mean, we have more people in jail than countries around the world that we would call authoritarian countries.
And Pennsylvania is one of the few states that life without parole is legal, right? So life without parole, you're getting a life sentence. No possibility of going out on parole. So they changed. So their name, the coalition's name, is Death by Incarceration, because it literally is that. You're going to die in that prison. Whether you reform your life or you change your views or you change your thoughts, no matter what. Right. And I met a woman yesterday, and I first talked to her because of the back of her shirt. It was a picture of her and I think her son back in 1986. He was so young. And then there's a picture next to her of her and this older man in 2016. And that's her son, still in jail, still incarcerated, years later, after he probably wasn't the same person that committed that crime. And there's actually juveniles here in Pennsylvania that are serving life without parole. That means you're going
but
in.
Aren't there crimes, though, that you relinquished? You relinquish. I mean, the crime is so heinous. Like murder, for example, you take another person's life.
And that's the thing. I want to hear that specific person's story, right? We can't say murder as a thing. And that's what Poor People's Campaign is trying to lift up, really, is individual stories, right? We can say right now someone murdered someone heinously, bloody, but I don't know that person's story. I would like for him to come in. Why did you murder that person, right? So we're taking a lot of point of way of asking people for why and what happened.
Why does why matter if it occurred?
Because if someone tried to murder me, I probably might not hold back, and I will kill you 10 times right. as harsh as you try to kill me.
We only have about 2 minutes left. Michael, you mentioned to me before we went on the air, and I don't think you said you're tired because you just got out of jail 9 hours ago.
Yes.
And civil disobedience is a big part of this. There were 24 arrests in Harrisburg yesterday, 13 arrests last week. I looked at some of the media coverage of the campaign, and one of the things I'm noticing is that a lot of that media coverage is focusing on the arrest, the civil disobedience part of it. And yes, they will talk, the stories will talk a little bit about the issues, but 75% of that story is about the arrest. How do you stop that?
Well, frankly, if we didn't have the arrests, there wouldn't be a story, period. Because these issues have been going on for a long time and they don't get covered. So the nonviolent civil disobedience raises the profile. It forces a moral crisis. It puts a situation in front of Pennsylvania where we have to say, are we going to deal with these issues or are we not going to deal with these issues? And when you do that in a dramatic way, you dramatize the issue, it does get media coverage, absolutely.
What did you do to get arrested?
For legal reasons, I'd rather not go too far into it, but essentially standing in a place of, in the Capitol that I shouldn't have been standing in. And just one last point about mass incarceration. We're also going after the corruption connections here because it's such a corrupt system. We have private prisons that funnel so much money to our politicians and have them just build prisons and have quotas for beds. And it just fuels the crisis. The words of Ezekiel are true. There are people in you who take bribes to shed blood. And that's the society we live in.
I have to say that this has been a great conversation. I enjoyed this conversation a whole lot. And there's so many issues we didn't get to.
Yeah,
but I want to thank you very much for being with us
today. To Harrisburg.
Leslie Avila, who's with the Movement of Immigrant Leaders, Rabbi Michael Pollack, March on Harrisburg, part of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. Thank you very much for being with us
today. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you for listening.
And see you in Harrisburg next week at every Monday from now until June 21st.
Spread love.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about clinical trials.